All right, welcome to class today. Glad to have you all with us. Before we begin, a little bit of logistics. So after grading what I thought was an unusually low number of submissions for quiz 9, I discovered that my new tool was losing about a third of the quizzes, not that didn't get uploaded, but that didn't make it into my grading system. And so then I started trying to debug and fix that. And anyway, you will notice that you may, about two-thirds of you, had an in-class quiz 9 grade posted for several hours. It is no longer there as I am trying to fix the bugs there. We do have your submissions, whether you had a grade there or not. And we will get them graded, but it sort of messed up my schedule and there's a fair number of tweaks I need to make to my system. A cautionary tale in not making changes to software products while they're in production. If I had had my druthers, I would have prepared between semesters, but that was not allowed. So anyway, we will get all of that sorted out. You currently also can't see your projected letter grade because discovered that the new system wasn't playing nicely with the old system there and we're getting nonsensical results. I have fixes underway for all of this that I hope to get done soon. However, I realized I'd spent so long messing around with that over the past 24 hours that I forgot to post a practice lab. So I'm going to prioritize getting that together in what time I have so that I can get that out in the next few hours, I hope. Although I've got lots of meetings on Wednesday. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, it has been a stressful past 24 hours for me. Sorry about that. We will get everything sorted out for you though. And in the meantime, before the lab posts, you can certainly look back over the fall 2019 information. Just as a reminder, if you want to see what was done in previous semesters, you can always go down here to the complete list of labs and quizzes here. And in particular, quiz 5 is the one where we talked about relations and functions to some degree, and there was a little bit on the final as well, changing somewhat how we're doing it, so it's not a perfect match. But I will try to get a good match posted as soon as I can. Okay. So there's that. We'll get it sorted. Sorry about the momentary stress. We'll sort it out and move forward as quickly as we can. Before I dive back into talking about functions and moving on to relations as well today, are there any other comments, questions, concerns, other things you would like me to address? All right. Then let's return to talking about functions and relations. Remember last time we talked about the idea that a function, we talked about several different properties of a function, okay? So we talked about the idea that functions have no state and no side effects. Meaning, in particular, that if you know what the arguments are, you can tell what the result will be, and it will always be the same, regardless of how many times you invoke it with the same arguments. So we have this general idea. Another consequence of this, that sort of came out of this, is it has one result per set of arguments. So for any given argument you happen to give it, it'll give you one result. Some functions are defined to return sequences, so multiple values internally or sets or the like, but the sequence or set itself is one value. And so we have this, you don't have a function that could map to two different things. It always does the same thing, therefore always returns the same value. And therefore, there are some things that we sometimes think about as functions that might not in practice always be them. For example, the square root of x, I should take a specific example, the square root of 4, if we're defining this as a function, we have to pick between 2 and negative 2. Both 2 and negative 2 square root of 4. And so both could be described as a square root of 4. But if we want to define the square root as a function, we have to pick just one of those answers to be what the function means, and pick it when we define the function rather than on each invocation, because it needs to always result in the same result given the same arguments. And so this is a characteristic of functions. We also talked about a few other properties of them. We talked about total versus partial, which had to do with, are there any elements of the domain, the set of arguments possible, that the function is undefined for? We talked about the idea of codomain versus range, where the codomain is the broad set that we intended our function to return values in, and the range is the subset of the codomain that can actually be reached by some argument given to the function. So for example, we might think about the squaring function. If we think about f of x as the squaring function, we might think about its domain being reals and its codomain being reals, but its range only being non-negative reals. And we could have defined, again, picking our codomain is up to us. It must include the range, but is generally a larger named set or a data type in programming around that. We also talked about the idea of being surjective and injective. And we were just starting bijective when we ran out of time. Okay, surjective or onto, injective or one-to-one, and bijective or invertible, or also sometimes called a correspondence. Okay, and we talked about the ideas that injective means different arguments yield different results. Okay, so I don't ever have two arguments that lead to the same thing. Surjective means the codomain is equal to the range. And bijective means both of those things. And we'll talk some more about bijective. A little bit of notation that is probably worth seeing, but we aren't going to spend a lot of time on in this class. When we want to talk about a function's type, we want to talk about the type of its domain and its codomain. And the traditional way of writing that is to use a colon, the domain, and the range, or the codomain, rather. This means this is the function. This means its type, that is to say, the sets of its domain and codomain are its domain set mapping to its codomain set. And you'll see this notation used a few times in our textbook, a few other places. In some branches of computing, it's quite common. So functional programming, for example, tends to talk about this quite a bit. If you go into programming languages, you'll probably see quite a bit more of this notation. In other places in computing, it's fairly rare. So we're not going to drill into this a whole lot, but it's worth noting that this exists. Okay. When we think about a surjective versus an injective function, before we get to bijective, let's talk just a little bit about why we might care. A surjective function, we can think of as being an okay sampling. In many cases in programming, we have some sort of unknown situation. We have some black box function or external oracle or human we're asking questions to, or some thing we want to understand, but we don't fully have a characterization of. And so we want to sample it. Okay? We want to pick some example inputs to try it out on. A surjective function has the property that if I put in an argument, I can eventually get all of the outputs. And so creating a surjection onto the thing I want to sample means that I won't sort of be biased against certain samples. And so surjective functions are sometimes used as a way of picking how we will sample from a space. There are lots of other ideas about sampling that will become important later on if you take some numerical methods classes. But this is one of the ideas. So we want to be able to reach everything. We can also think about the test writing function inside your head. If your test writing function is surjective, then if you keep writing tests, eventually you'll test all behaviors. If it's not surjective, then you can keep writing tests forever and never test certain behaviors. And so surjective has this nice behavior that sort of covers the space we want to deal with. Injective makes something an okay encoding. Okay. That is to say, if I want to encode some value in some way, I want to make sure that two values encode to different things, right? Because if two things can encode to the same thing, then I've lost information. So injective is useful in all kinds of compression algorithms, wire encoding, sending signals. We always want something injective so that if you give me two different messages, I'll end up with two different results. I don't necessarily need something surjective. It might be okay to have an encoding system that skips some possible encodings, and that can actually help me detect errors if I do that. But I want to make sure that if you give me two different messages, I encode them as two different things, that it is theoretically possible for me to recover the original message. And so there's more probably cases where we care about injective than surjective, but both of these are characteristics we're going to care about for functions we want to encode and verify things about. Bijective has this very nice property that's probably worth talking about a little bit more. We had drawn some pictures about surjective and the injective last time, and the textbook also has them. But if we imagine our domain and our codomain, the characteristic of bijective, because it is surjective, everything in the codomain has to have something that maps to it. And because it's injective, everything in the domain has to map to only one thing in the codomain, which means that we end up with this sort of one-to-one relationship, this direct mapping. Everything in the domain maps to something in the codomain, assuming we're total, and everything in the codomain has mapped by something different in the domain. And so we have this correspondence, this sort of relationship between elements. And this is useful in various, so we can think of this as being an okay representation. In particular, if we count the members of the codomain, we've also counted the members of the domain because there are the same number of them. And so we actually used this property last week when we were talking about counting donut purchases. We started by saying we're purchasing some number of donuts of several different flavors. But then we showed that we could make a bijection to this idea of a bunch of circles with some lines between them. And this was a bijection because every order of donuts could map into it. So we had mapped into a different encoding. So it was injective, everything mapped to something different, and every encoding we could come up with represented some set of donuts. So it was also surjective, making it this bijection. Because we had applied a bijection to a sort of an abstract problem, ended up with a concrete problem we knew how to work with, because it was a bijection, our counting worked back and forth. Okay, so are all surjective functions injective? No, not all surjective functions are injective. So as an example of a surjective function that is not injective, let's consider a function from the real numbers to the Booleans. And in particular, I will say f of x is defined to be x is less than 0. Okay, this is a surjection. It goes onto every element of the domain. I can find a real number that gives me true, a real number that gives me false. That is the entire codomain. So I also have, it's also the entire range. It is surjective. It is not injective because there are many different values that all map to the same element. And it is also not bijective, because to be bijective, it would have to be injective and surjective. And in general, I can't get a bijection unless my domain and codomain have the same number of elements in them, although that number could be infinite. All right. Another useful property about bijections is because they are invertible, that means that knowing that for any bijective F, there exists some well-defined F inverse. I can create an undo function, okay? Something that will get back to where I started. You could argue this only actually requires surjection, but this is also going to be total, which is the nice thing about it being bijective, right? So if you give me a total bijective function, something that will never have an error, I can give you its total inverse, something that will never have an error and undoes what we did. And inverses of functions are useful in various properties. A fair amount of encryption, for example, relies on the existence of inverses. I want to take some message, encode it in some other thing, and then I want to guarantee there's some way of unencoding it regardless of what you created. And so this notion of invertibility will also be useful in functions we'll want to deal with. And because of that, in my experience in programming, it's actually more common to call them invertible than bijective, although only slightly. So the surjective versus onto, injective versus one-to-one, and bijective invertible correspondence, you'll see all of these to some degree. The most common phrases in my experience are surjective and injective, and they seem to be increasing in popularity over one-to-one and onto over time. And then invertible is also probably the most used of the terms there. All right. Any questions about any of these terminologies or these sort of hand-wavy use cases we might care about for them? All right. A generalization of the idea of function, or a specialization of it, depending on your perspective, there's this other idea of a relation, okay? There's several ways of thinking about relation. One way is as a function that can have multiple outputs, okay? So if I were to take, for example, something that we would graph like this, this will not be a function because there exists some x that should have multiple y's, but it would be a relation. I can say that there are certain x's and y's that are related to each other. This is one way of thinking about a relation. Another way of thinking about a relation is it is a function of two or more arguments that has the booleans as its codomain. And these are actually equivalent statements. These are saying the same thing, although it's probably not obvious how they are doing that, okay? So if we think about, let's take the classic equation of a circle. X squared plus y squared equals 1. The set of x, y coordinates for which this is defined is a circle. And so I could say that any given point on that circle that you happen to pick is in the relation. That point is related. So if I pick my favorite x here, something where x squared plus y squared equals 1. Let's see if I can happen to remember of any of these off the top of my head. I believe 6 squared plus 8 squared, if memory serves, is 1. I'm probably wrong. Nope, I am wrong. Let's take the square root of 2 for both x and y. If x is the square root of 2 and y is the square root of 2, then I'm on this circle. I am exactly this point right there. Okay. That is a point that is in the relation. So there's a couple of ways I could think about this. I could think about it as sort of this equation that tells me the points that are related. You pick an x, y, this will tell me whether they're related or not. And so I can think of it as sort of this idea of sort of rewriting this in functional form. I can say that y equals x squared minus 1 plus or minus. Okay. And that plus or minus gives me this idea of multiple outputs. So this is one way of thinking about it, but I could also think about it as this predicate over x and y's. I could define this special predicate that is true if x squared plus y squared equals 1, and is false otherwise. And then my graph, the line on my graph, becomes the set of points for which the relation is true, and all other sets of points it is false. And any of these functions that might have multiple outputs can be termed a relation. A function only has one output can also be termed a relation. I can always rewrite my functions as a relation. And I can always think of my relations as being this generalization of functions. We can go back and forth between them. In programming and much of code, we're going to primarily think about a relation as being this sort of computational predicate, this idea of some value that produces true or false. But we'll also think about, are things related, right? So we call these a relation because we would say, if we are thinking about this, we would say that x squared is related to x squared by the circle relation. This phrasing does not show up a great deal in computing, but does show up occasionally. And so we can think about this idea. Let's try to formalize this notion as we will care about it in what we are doing. Okay? We will typically write a relation exactly like we would a predicate. Okay? And most of what we think about from predicates will just work. Okay? However, wouldn't root 2... Oh, yes, sorry. I said root 2 here, and I meant root 1 over 2. Thank you for that correction. Oh, 0.6 and 0.8 actually worked. That's cool. I didn't realize I remembered that. All right. So I guess perhaps because it's a little awkward, we could also say 0.6 is related to 0.8 by circle as well, right? And we could also say that 0.6 is related to negative 0.8, and negative 0.6 is related to 0.8, and so forth, right? There's going to be lots of these pairs that are going to be related to each other. All right. We're often going to deal with these as predicates. If we were thinking about them sort of in a typed programming language, we would think about making some function of arbitrary types that always returns a Boolean, always returns true or false. If you've only seen untyped languages, then we don't have these typing systems. But this idea that we have a function that can take whatever the types are we care about, whatever the types we're relating are, and tells me whether they are true or false. And so some of the most common relations we're going to deal with are equals and less than. These are both relations, okay? They're both relations that are going to sort of take two numbers and tell me either yes or no, right? So these are relations between numbers in general, although in programming we often want to compare other things, strings, lists, and so forth. And so writing functions that have these properties is going to be important. And understanding if we have come up with a good function will deal with some properties we're going to care about relations. Okay. So just like when we're thinking about functions, we're interested in, are they surjective, injective, bijective? when we're thinking about relations, we're also going to have a set of things we're interested in. And the set of properties we talk about the most about relations are reflexive, reflexive, symmetric, and transitive. Symmetric. And let's talk about what we mean by these. A reflexive relation has the property that R of X, X is true for all X. Everything is related to itself. This will be true about equals. We want everything to equal itself. So we expect equals to be a reflexive expression. We expect it to not be true for any values for less than. We don't want to say anything is less than itself, okay? And so we also have this notion of being irreflexive. This term shows up less commonly in context, but this means that it is not reflexive for anything. This means in particular that for all x, it is not the case that R of x, x. And this is something we would expect for the less than relation. And it is important to know, as we're designing algorithms that will use comparison functions or the like, use relations to figure out what's going on, to know what will happen in these cases. If I decide to write some sort of sorting algorithm, and I'm trying to find sort of a unique sort, but occasionally the sorting algorithm says two things are the same when they aren't, or it allows me to say things are the same, this can break that algorithm. So recognizing whether something is reflexive or not will be an important characteristic of making usable functions that will allow us to guarantee properties of others. Symmetric is the concept that if I'm related to you, then you're related to me. So if X is related to Y, then that is exactly equivalent to saying Y is related to X. Okay? And this is, again, something we expect to be true of equals. We expect that if X equals Y, Y equals X, and I don't have to check both directions. One is enough. There is also this notion of anti-symmetric. Anti-symmetric is sort of this converse property, right? Anti-symmetric says that for all x, y, if x is not equal to y, then r of x, y implies not r of y, x. Okay? And so anti-symmetry is something we want of the less than. Anti-symmetry has a special extra clause if X is not equal to Y. And that's primarily so that we can talk about symmetry and reflexiveness without talking about each other. So if you're looking at the same thing, we're in the reflexive or irreflexive space. If we're looking at different things, then we can start thinking about symmetry. And this also allows us to say things like less than or equal is also anti-symmetric. Because as long as X is not equal to Y, X less than or equal to Y will not be the same as Y less than or equal to X. Transitive, and I really should have given myself more space here, sorry. Oh, I guess I can. Why is that not, yeah, let's just give ourselves more space. All right, the transitive property is this idea that if I'm related to you and you're related to somebody else, then I'm related to that somebody else. So for all X, Y, and Z, this says that if X is related to Y and Y is related to Z, then X is related to Z. And this is something we want to actually be true of both less than and equal, right? We want all of these to have this property. We want to have this sort of notion, and part of what this gives us is this idea that we don't have loops. Okay. If everything is related in sort of in chains, then we end up with the ability to make sure these chains go someplace. Let's try to give some more sort of real world senses of some of these ideas. So let's just consider some relations that might exist in the real world. Let's start with how about ancestor? Okay. If I define some relation xy to be x is an ancestor of y, we can start to think about, is this a reflexive, symmetric, transitive, irreflexive, anti-symmetric? What are the characteristics that this relationship has? Okay, so remember, an ancestor is your parents or their parents or their parents and so on back into antiquity. So as I think about this, I don't expect to call myself my own ancestor. And I would be sort of surprised if anybody tried to say they were their own ancestor. So I expect this to be irreflexive. I don't expect anybody to be their own ancestor. If it was symmetric, that would mean that if you're my ancestor, then I'm your ancestor. I don't expect that to be the case. So I expect this to be anti-symmetric. If anybody were to say, I have a pair of people who are both each other's ancestors, I would be a little surprised. Although there actually have been several songs trying to create weird pedigrees about this that are not particularly popular today. But anyway, this idea that only one of a pair of people can be an ancestor of the other, anti-symmetry. And I expect my ancestors' ancestors to be my ancestors. So I expect this to be transitive. Okay, so we think about the ancestor relationship between people. This is a behavior we expect it to reflect. All right. So we can think about some others. Let's suppose I define another relation. And let's say that this is X is a friend of Y. And then we can ask ourselves, does this have any of these properties? Let's just work through them. Reflexive. Is everybody their own friend? If it was reflexive, everybody would be their own friend. If it's irreflexive, nobody would be their own friend. If some people are their own friend and some aren't, it will be neither reflexive or irreflexive. And you can argue about the definition of friend if it requires different people to say they're friends. But I certainly have heard people talk about being their own best friend and so on. So I'm going to argue that sometimes people can be their own friend, but I've also heard people talk about being their own enemy. So perhaps sometimes it doesn't apply. And so I'm going to argue that it's probably neither reflexive nor irreflexive. That friend is, could be reflexive, could be irreflexive for any given individual, but the relation as a whole has neither property, okay? So this is not reflexive in general because some people don't like themselves, aren't friends with themselves. It is not irreflexive because some people do consider themselves their own friend. And so it has neither of those properties. It is important to note that because these are both universally quantified, there are certainly circumstances where neither of them will hold. So we don't actually have to have any of these properties or their opposites in general. We could then ask about symmetry. If you're my friend, am I your friend? This has sort of a more complicated circumstance. Some people say you're not friends unless you both like each other. And with that definition of friend, then friend would be symmetric. Other people say friend is something I feel about you, even if you don't feel it about me. And so they might argue that it isn't necessarily symmetric. So does this mean it's based on how we perceive the question? Yeah, that's the challenge with English. What do we mean by this word? right? And this is part of the reason why sometimes even the process of asking questions and trying to define your terms is important. Remember, way back to our first class, we talked about the habits of highly mathematical people. And one of them was define the term. Asking these questions about relations helps you recognize if you have defined it properly or not. Okay, so in the process of trying to define is friend reflexive or not, I have defined more fully what I mean about the word friend. What do I mean by irreflexive? Irreflexive is nothing is related to itself. Okay, so if no value is related to itself, I'll tidy that up, then it is irreflexive. So nobody is their own ancestor. It's an irreflexive relationship. If somebody can be their own friend, then it isn't necessarily irreflexive. If everybody's their own friend, then it's reflexive. So along the way here, what I'm likely to end up having to do is to define friend more precisely so that I can answer these kinds of questions. If I can't answer the questions, then the relation I had in my head was ill-defined. So I could define friend as meaning two people who like each other. If this is my definition of friend, then by definition, it becomes symmetric. Because I've said they like each other. I like you and you like me, therefore we are friends. This is by definition a symmetric situation. Depending on what I meant by two people, I could argue this also has become irreflexive. Okay. And so I can sort of tweak my definitions to try to explore different possibilities of how these relationships work. Virtually every definition of friend I know of, though, is not transitive. While it is possible for me to be friends with somebody and them to be friends with somebody else and me to be friends with the first, right? So I could be friends with one of you and you're friends with another one of you and I could be friends with both. And so we could have some transitive circumstances. In general, the friends of my friends are not necessarily my friends. I have friends who I don't consider their friends my friends. I have friends I haven't even met their friends. Friends I don't like their friends. And so it's going to not be transitive. Okay. And I don't know of any reasonable definition of friend where we would say it's transitive. I also don't know of any reasonable definition of friend where we would try to say it is never transitive, right? Never transitive is such a rare thing that it doesn't even have a commonly used term like irreflexive and antisymmetric. So we have these ideas. Okay. Thoughts, comments, questions so far? All right. There are 2.5 kinds of relations that we care about a great deal in many computing circumstances. The first is the equivalence relation. An equivalence relation is any relation that is reflexive, symmetric, and transitive. The fact that that is what it is, though, is not perhaps as enlightening as why we call it an equivalence relation. If we imagine the space of all possible values that could exist, the characteristic that is interesting about equivalence relation is it becomes a partition of the space. There is some breakdown of the space so that everything in each of the buckets is equivalent to everything else in that bucket and not to anything else. Okay. So this forms a partition. It splits the space into different buckets, where all are equivalent to each other under this equivalence relation. We can tell it has to do this first off because any bucket we do includes a point, and that is reflexively related to itself. It also, if it includes two points, if one's related to the other, they have to be related back. So symmetry is part of this. And because of transitivity, if I'm related to you and you're related to somebody else, then I'm related as well. And so we end up with a scenario where everything inside of any given bucket we draw, all pairs of points and every point by itself, are all going to be related to themselves. And that'll be true for any given partition we can draw that doesn't cross over an equivalence. So any given equivalence relation defines a partition. And any partition defines an equivalence relation. Equivalence relations are useful in various kinds of situations where you would think you would want to check identity. So equals equals in many programming languages is designed to be an equivalence relation. Some languages will have a separate kind of equals or a separate kind of equals or separate kind of equals. There's lots of kinds of equals in many programming languages. And part of the reason we have several is because there's various things where we want to bucket things and say they're equivalent. But there's different rules we might want to use to do that. And so virtually every programming language I know has at least two different kinds of equals. And several of them have more than that. And all of them are designed to be equivalence relations so that properties we expect to hold about equality will work for them. So when you are writing programs, you are likely to need to write the implementation of one or more of these functions for any new data type you create. And if it doesn't have the reflexive, symmetric, and transitive properties, it is likely the algorithms that depend on equivalence relations will fail to work correctly with your type. So writing equivalence relations will be an important characteristic for that purpose. The other one we talk about is orders. In particular, there's the idea of a partial and a total. And we'll get to the difference of partial and total in a moment. But the partial order or the total order, they're both designed to behave like less than. They're designed to sort of put things in an order. So a partial or total order is going to need to be anti-symmetric. And it is going to need to be transitive. Okay, we don't want to be able to reverse the order of arguments and still have them be related because the order matters, hence anti-symmetry. And we want one thing that's related to another to keep working. And so this is going to create an ordering of things. We call it a partial order if this ordering function only is undefined for some values. And we call it a total order if every value has it work. Okay, there's a little bit more nuance in what we mean by have it work that has to do with reflexivity and sort of is there equivalence buckets internally. But the idea of this is what we're going to need for less than or less than equal or all of those related things or the comparator function, compare to or comparator or comp. Again, programming languages have dozens of instances of order functions. And like with equivalence relations, we're going to make sure that when we write our own thing, our new version works correctly. Let me just give you an example. Let's suppose I define a bad order, something that is not in order. Let's suppose I were to define my less than function. If you give me two values, I will say they're less than. I will say if x is 0, I could say it like this. I could say Let me actually just draw this. This will be easier. If I imagine just three numbers, I could say that 0 is less than 1, 1 is less than 2, 2 is less than 3, and 3 is less than 0. This is not an order, okay? Because if I were to try to assume that it was transitive, that would suggest that 0 should be related to 2, and therefore related to 3, and therefore related to itself. And here we see we have some symmetry being created if we make this transitive version of it. Okay, so there's no way of making this loop be transitive and anti-symmetric. If this is the relationship I decided to make in my code, and then I were to try to sort a list using this less than operator, that sorting function would not be guaranteed to do anything predictable. Because I don't know that my ordering is sane, that my ordering is in fact an order. Okay, this is not an order. Often we'll call them partial orders, even if they're total, right? So this is part that just sort of to, because for whatever reason they aren't called order relations. So we typically call them partial order is the generic term. This is not a partial order, which means that if I try to use it in a place I expect a partial order, guarantees like my sorting algorithm will terminate to no longer hold. And so again, understanding that the code I wrote is an equivalence relation, that the code I wrote is a partial order, that has the appropriate properties, is important to make other code that uses my code also behave correctly. Similarly, if we back up to some of these earlier ideas, if I have a program that's calling my function and it expected a total function, but I give it a partial function, it might crash. Okay? If I try to encode something with something that's not surjective, I can't necessarily get back, and so forth. Right? So often what we need to do in practice with these different properties is to verify that the code we wrote had the right set of properties. And because of that, it's relatively common to see various APIs and descriptions of how you're supposed to write your code tell you these properties, the subset of these properties your function needs to have. And then you have to be able to actually implement it. Okay, thoughts, comments, questions? All right. What do I expect you to actually be able to do when it comes to this? The main thing I expect you to be able to do is, given a function or relation definition, answer is this whatever the thing is, transitive, reflexive, symmetric, anti-symmetric, and so forth. And since this is what I want you to do, and since these are words you're gonna hear about a lot for our last minute and a half here, let me see if I can give you some little mnemonics to try to remember what things mean. Let me start with the ones I think are probably easiest. An onto function goes, if we think about a function of taking me off of the domain and onto the codomain, then the onto function gets onto all of the codomain, right? If I think about the sort of the output of my function as getting part of the other thing wet, this gets all of it wet. It covers all of it. It goes on to everything. One to one, we can remember because it says there is only one thing that maps to any one thing, okay? And how do these relate to injective and surjective? I have not found that most people find it easy to remember injective and surjective. If you remember that these are the two, injective and one sort of both start with vowels and written out. They both start with things that look sort of like ones if you write digits, and therefore the other one is the other. I know that's not great. It's the best I've got. when we come to these other things, okay, reflexive is intended to sort of think about a mirror. So why we call it reflection. It's designed to think about your reflection, okay? And the idea is when you look at a mirror, you see yourself. You may also be able to see other things, right? A reflexive function isn't limited to only seeing itself, but you can see yourself. And so the idea is if you're reflexive, then you're related to yourself. Symmetry suggests that I can that a different ordering will still work, that the symmetric reflection of what I'm doing will still have the same property, or that it doesn't matter what order I do things in because it is symmetric. And transitive is intended to create the idea that I can travel. If I can get from X to Y and I can get from Y to Z, then I can get eventually via an intermediate hop potentially to the other part, okay? And so these are hopefully going to be somewhat useful for you. That is the time we have. I will try again to get a lab posted as soon as I can, given the other constraints I have on trying to get things fixed, and then try to get your grades posted correctly. Sorry again about the headaches that this has caused. And I will look forward to seeing you all on Friday.